Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd, and for Brian Lehrer, we turn now to the U.S. Supreme Court and the cases that have started coming down, as they do every year at this time. On the court's calendar this term, everything from affirmative action to the big gay marriage case out of California and lots of other smaller but still important cases in between. To help us consider it all, from the legal to the broader policy implications, I'm so pleased to have Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. Adam, I know what a busy time this is for you, and I thank you so much for being here.
It's good to be here, Jimmy.
Now, Adam, today is perhaps slightly less busy than others at this time of year for you, because last I checked, we have no cases reported from the court this morning. Is that right?
That's right. And the next scheduled day for decisions is Monday. So the rest of the week ought to be relatively peaceful.
All right. Well, don't tempt us. We may call you back tomorrow. Let's take a moment to talk about one or two of the cases that have come down already this term, almost under the radar, because most people think June is the big month for Supreme Court, and it is, but already there have been one or two important decisions. Let's talk about that farming case I like so much. It has such a human face on it. Vernon Hugh Bowman is actually the farmer's name out in Indiana. He purchased some beans from Monsanto, the big agribusiness, but he didn't pay a licensing fee. So when he reproduced the beans, Monsanto sued. It reminds me a little of Jack and the Beanstalk and the Big Giant, right, Adam? What was so special about these beans?
Well, they're patented genetically modified beans. And I got to tell you, Jamie, this is the case everybody wants to talk about. The court didn't view it as particularly hard. It was a unanimous decision written by Justice Kagan that said once you've patented something that can reproduce itself, that means that no one's allowed to make copies of it, even if the copying is what farmers have done since time immemorial, which is to plant crops and save seed from their crops. So the court unanimously said Monsanto was entitled to stop farmers, including this Indiana farmer, Vernon Bowman, from making copies of its patented seed.
And you've written about unanimity in the court this term, and hopefully we'll have time to talk about that at the end. But the court had a couple of decisions, a couple of companion cases, on which they weren't in agreement. This week in the criminal justice arena, the court made it easier to challenge criminal convictions. The justices saying a one-year filing deadline for prisoners to seek federal review of their state court convictions can actually be relaxed if they have some compelling evidence of their innocence. But this is not one of those where the justices came together. These were two companion cases, but the court was divided, wasn't it?
Now, this week's decisions were what you expect from June decisions, which is 5-4 decisions in which the swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, either joins with the four liberals or joins with the four conservatives. And in this case, in two criminal justice cases, he joins with the liberals to make it easier for inmates to challenge their sentences and do what, you know, most people would think would be obvious, which is if someone can prove they're innocent, it doesn't matter if they come up with that evidence early or late. But the court said that a federal law that imposed a one-year deadline on coming forward with such claims can sometimes be relaxed.
And I imagine we'll continue to look for more split decisions and Justice Kennedy, what he'll be doing as we look ahead to the more anticipated decisions in June, what my con law professor used to call the big decision dump at the end of the term.
That's what we call it, too.
Yeah. And so let's talk about some of the biggest cases that will be coming down in the final days and weeks of the term. And let's start with arguably the biggest cases of all, at least the ones that have garnered the most national attention, the same-sex marriage cases. And there are actually two in the Supreme Court this term. Let's take them one at a time. First, there's Hollingsworth versus Perry. It's known more commonly as the Proposition 8 case. The Prop 8 case has been down, I guess, what we could call a long and winding procedural road. It began way back in 2004 when Mayor Gavin Newsom famously opened San Francisco City Hall to gay couples who wanted to get married. Adam, how did we get from that culturally significant moment to this legally significant one?
Well, without walking through the entire pathway, there comes a time when California's voters unhappy with a California Supreme Court decision that had authorized same-sex marriage, vote for a voter initiative called Proposition 8, which bans same-sex marriage in California. And that ban is challenged by two celebrity lawyers, Ted Olson and David Boies, who are on opposite sides of Bush v. Gore. Here they join together to say that Proposition 8 violates the federal constitution. And that case makes its way to the Supreme Court and has the potential, remote, but nonetheless, the potential to give rise to a constitutional rule that would require all 50 states to allow same-sex marriage. I think that outcome is unlikely. I think, judging from the argument, the court doesn't want to move too fast in this area, and that a likely outcome is maybe a California-only ruling, or maybe not even that. But there's a whole array of options, for all the way from saying the Constitution has nothing to say on this subject to saying that every state, including Alabama and Mississippi, where such a ruling would be very unpopular, is required to marry same-sex couples.
Now, Adam, this has been compared by many to the Loving decision, Loving versus Virginia, mm-hmm. which was the case in 1967 in which the U.S. Supreme Court deemed laws that prevented intermarriage between racial groups unconstitutional. Is that a fair comparison?
I think the analogy is quite strong. And the question to ask about Loving, which, as you say, is 1967, when there were only 16 states that still banned interracial marriage, came at a time when the country was ready to accept it, and whether we, in an age where 12 states now allow same-sex marriage and the balance don't, whether the court might think that it's moving too fast and might give rise to a kind of backlash.
So there is a question, a specific legal question, an issue specifically drawn in the case that the justices will be deciding. We talk, of course, in broader terms when we speak of this as lay people, but what specifically are the justices considering in the case?
Well, broadly speaking, there are two questions. One is whether it violates equal protection to treat same-sex couples differently from opposite-sex couples. And the other is whether it violates a fundamental right recognized by the Supreme Court on countless occasions for people to get married.
And you say that the justices have many options, and among those options would be to never reach those issues?
That's right. There's a substantial question about whether anyone has standing to bring this case to the Supreme Court. The case itself was brought by two couples who wanted to get married against California state officials. And there was a trial, and after the trial, they won. But the state officials did not appeal. The people who appealed and claimed they could step into the state's shoes were the proponents of Proposition 8. But it's not clear that they've suffered the kind of injury that allows them the right to appeal. And it may be that the court says, listen, we can't decide this because there's nobody before us who has standing. And that will give rise to a lot of confusion on the ground about what that means. It almost certainly means the appeals court decision, which also ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, gets vacated, gets X'd out. It probably leaves standing the decision in favor of the two couples, but maybe only those two couples. And there will be a lot of confusion if that's the way the court comes out. And there was some indication that that answer was attractive to four or five justices.
During the questioning.
That's right.
Now, there's the related case, consideration of the Defense of Marriage Act, a federal law. That's Windsor versus the United States. That case has a human face on it also, as most Supreme Court cases do. We talk about them so legalistically, sometimes we forget that there are people that launch these cases at some point in the procedural posture. That litigation started when Edie Windsor's longtime companion died, and Miss Windsor was forced to assume an estate tax bill that was much larger than that a straight survivor would have had to pay. And that was because her partner was a woman and the federal government didn't recognize their same-sex marriage, even though, and I think this is the significant part, even though their home state of New York did recognize their marriage. So the federal DOMA, of course, defines marriage as a union between one man and one woman. Now, Adam, I suppose the legal issue here is whether the federal government can deny tax and health and pension benefits to same-sex couples, even if they live in states where they can legally be married?
Exactly right. It's an equal protection question also. But the justices will find it easier because no answer they give in that case is going to require any state, that doesn't want to marry gay people to marry gay people. It only applies in those states where same-sex couples are already lawfully married, but as Justice Ginsburg said at the argument, they get a kind of skim milk version of marriage where they get state benefits but not federal benefits. So this is a case, unlike Proposition 8, where states' rights and gay rights are on the same side, and that makes it quite likely that Justice Kennedy, who has been quite strong on gay rights issues, will join the liberals to strike down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and that it will have the consequence of guaranteeing benefits in those states that already allow marriage, but not tell other states that don't want to marry gay people that they must marry gay people.
And this is the case the Obama administration refused to defend the federal law. Is that this case?
That's right. Well, the administration has taken just about every conceivable posture toward this law. It initially enforced and defended. It currently is enforcing the law but not defending it in court. And the president has really evolved on this issue from saying this is a matter for the states to decide to fairly late in the day in the other case, the Proposition 8 case, saying that there is a federal constitutional right to marriage.
Now, let's talk affirmative action, another traditionally hot-button issue in our country. The case is Fisher versus UT Austin, University of Texas at Austin, and there is a challenge to the school's race-conscious admissions policy. A young woman named Abigail Fisher is suing UT Austin when her college application was rejected back in 2008. She was still a high school senior. I guess this is another story with a human face, and she claims she was turned away in part because she is white and that she had a more qualified application than some minority applicants. But, Adam, there's another side to the story, that of UT Austin. What do they say?
They say that they should be allowed to take account of race as one factor of many to ensure a diverse student body, which they say gives kids generally a better educational experience. And that's the theory that the court endorsed only 10 years ago in a case out of the University of Michigan, saying you can't have quotas, you can't have numerical standards, but you can, in the way admissions officers like to talk, have a holistic admissions process where race is one factor among many, and you can take account of race in that soft and fuzzy kind of way. And here, just 10 years later, with the replacement of the author of that 10-year-old decision, Justice O'Connor, by the more conservative Justice Alito, we might get a different answer from the Supreme Court.
But Adam, how are we back here again? Hasn't the issue of affirmative action been decided by previous decisions, like the famous Bakke decision, which was a household name for so many years, and then more recently Grutter versus Bollinger? How is it that we're still talking about affirmative action?
Well, a shift in personnel at the court will sometimes give you a different answer to the same question. It's also true that the Texas system is quite idiosyncratic. It uses holistic admissions for just a small part of its student body. For most of it, it uses a race-neutral means of getting people into the University of Texas by allowing anyone graduating the top 10% of a Texas high school automatically to get in. Because Texas high schools are largely segregated, that generates very substantial diversity. So the question in the new case is a little different from the older ones. You can say the question in the new case is, if you're already getting diversity through a race-neutral means, can you layer on top of that additional race-conscious means?
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Adam Liptak, of course, of the New York Times. I would say a scholar on the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as their Supreme Court correspondent. Adam, I can't end this conversation without asking you about voting rights. That's another topic you think would be resolved in this country, and I guess that's the argument of the petitioners in the case. The issue is the continued use by the federal government of one of the key enforcement provisions of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965, specifically Section 5 of the Act, which gives federal authorities oversight of states and localities with a history of voter discrimination. And I guess it's worth noting that all or parts of 16 states, and that includes parts of New York City.
That's right.
Which, many people would be surprised to hear. But in this case, Alabama and North Carolina filed suit after the provision was reauthorized back in 2006, saying that it's burdensome and no longer necessary, unwarranted. So, Adam, I think the court has signaled in some prior cases the likely outcome in this case. And would you agree with that? And if so, what is going to be the impact of the decision here?
The court came very close to striking down that key part of the Voting Rights Act in 2009. And there's good reason to think that they're going to do something negative about the Voting Rights Act in the next couple of weeks. It might not go so far as to say that that central provision, which sometimes requires states to come to Washington and get permission from federal officials or from a court here before their laws become valid, which is a significant intrusion on state sovereignty. What the court seems likely to do is to say, we don't think there's anything wrong with that idea in principle, but we think the set of states and localities that are currently in the coverage formula, those states to which this provision applies, called Section 5, are not the right set of jurisdictions anymore. Because when Congress in 2006 reauthorized the law, it didn't take a fresh look at where there was discrimination going on. It relied on data from the 1970s. And the court may well say, that data is too old, Congress. If you want to do this, you have to rely on current data about where there are problems with discrimination.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you. There is never enough time, but I want to thank you for the time you've given us. I want to thank you also and commend to our listeners for a piece you wrote just last week about Alton T. Lemon, a civil rights advocate, about his passing at the age of 84 and his contribution to civil rights. And I hope people will go to the New York Times website and read that piece. I want to thank you for that, Adam.
Well, thank you for having me, Jamie, and thanks for pointing that out. And as you pointed out throughout, there are human beings involved in all these cases, and they really help bring to life the issues in them.
As do you in your writing. Adam Liptak is a New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and you can follow him on Twitter. And coming up next, we take a legal turn to legal weed, the conclusion of Brian's series on the legalization of marijuana. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer.